From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Tomorrow in Cooperstown, two more major leaguers will be inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame. Ahead in Only a Game, the convergent paths of Ricky Henderson and Jim Rice. Also a conversation with Zev Chapitz, author of Cooperstown Confidential, and our own Doug Trabu reports on the 100-mile Vermont endurance race that sometimes has humans and horses jockeying for trail space. Also ahead, a tour of the swimming facility Benito Mussolini hoped would inspire Italy to greatness.
The curious mosaics are these ones with tanks and aeroplanes and soldiers. So it's saying finally Italy has its empire. It sort of looks like an ancient mosaic, but then we have tanks in it.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Tomorrow, Jim Rice, late of the Boston Red Sox, and Ricky Henderson, late of most of the major league teams, will be inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York. During the week prior to the ceremony, Rice, a prodigious slugger who drove in more than 100 runs 8 times, was asked to comment on the achievements of Henderson, a base stealer without peer.
I would have loved to have played with Ricky. So, I mean, I would have had more RBIs. That's what I look at.
For years, Rice came up short in the balloting. He made the Hall in the final year before his eligibility would have run out. Among those who feels justice has finally been done is Peter Gammons of ESPN, who is referred to by many of his fellow baseball writers as the commissioner.
His career was built on 12 monumental years. I mean, you have, in a 12-year period, he finished in the top five for MVP 6 times, which means that he was one of the dominant players of his era. The 3 years, 77 through 79, he was so much better than any other hitter in baseball that in the end, that and his reliability, because he played hurt. I can remember having him crack bones in his hand. I think those are the things that got him to the Hall, and that's why I voted for him almost every time.
Asked about his legacy this week, Jim Rice didn't have to think about his answer.
I think when they speak of me or they speak of the Red Sox or they speak of the Green Monster, that's what they're going to think about. William Jastrzemski and Rice.
The honoree was referring to the fact that between 1939, when Ted Williams arrived in Boston, and 1988, Jim Rice's last year as a full-time position player, left field in Fenway Park was the preserve of only 3 men, the second of them being Carl Yastrzemski, all of them now Hall of Famers. Rice's fellow honoree, Ricky Henderson, was baseball's greatest leadoff hitter, and in 1982, incredibly, he stole 130 bases. But perhaps his signature statement was the leadoff home run. In a conference call this week, Henderson explained why he began hitting them.
Leading off a home run came in my later career. You know, I think, you know, when I, you know, probably was stealing all the bases, and then, you know, when you had to go to arbitration, they said, you know, the only the big boys make the money. And I said, I'm scoring all the runs, and they said, only the big boy voted, so you got to hit, they got to hit hitting home runs. So I got to try to figure out how to hit a home run, too.
Both Rice and Henderson have expressed some trepidation about the speeches they'll be called upon to make tomorrow. Henderson has indicated that former manager Billy Martin is among the people he'll thank, and earlier this spring he let Peter Gammons in on what visitors to the Hall of Fame can expect.
I actually interviewed him. And I said, have you started writing your speech? He said, yes. I said, how many times are you going to say I am the greatest? He said, I will say it.
In some baseball fans, the Hall of Fame inspires awe. Zev Chapitz is not one of those fans. His new book is titled Cooperstown Confidential, Heroes, Rogues, and the Inside Story of the Baseball Hall of Fame. And in the introduction, he claims that on the members' platform at the induction ceremony last year, he noticed, quote, a convicted drug dealer, a reformed cokehead, a celebrated sex addict, and a well-known and highly arrested drunk driver, among others, all washed clean by the magical powers of Cooperstown. Zev Chapitz joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Zev, if you list alphabetically the members of the Hall's first class of inductees, that list begins with Ty Cobb, who received 98.23% of the possible votes. What would happen if somebody were to retroactively apply the Hall's so-called character clause to Mr. Cobb?
Well, probably nothing would happen because the Hall's character clause, which says that only players of integrity and sportsmanship and good character can be inducted, has never been actually honored since it was first enacted in 1944.
I don't know if Cobb was the worst of the bunch. As I mentioned in the introduction, you list a reformed cokehead, a celebrated sex addict, a convicted drug dealer. I know the sex addict was Wade Boggs. I'm not sure who all the other guys were. But was Cobb the worst of the bunch?
Well, Cobb was pretty bad. Cobb once bragged to a sports writer that he murdered somebody. And although nobody could turn up any evidence of that, it's still a guy who brags about killing somebody like that is a pretty bad guy. On the other hand, there were two members of the Hall of Fame who were in the Ku Klux Klan that we know of, Tris Speaker and Rogers Hornsby. Joe DiMaggio and Hank Greenberg, who I love dearly, both had very intimate mob ties. So did Leo DeRocher. I guess it depends on what you think a bad character is.
Players elected to the Hall get a plaque describing their accomplishments, and they get a ceremony honoring their achievements. They also receive considerable financial benefits. Describe some of those.
Well, there are certain players that getting into the Hall of Fame is not so economically important for them because they're transcendent stars, a guy like Koufax, who only signs a couple of times a year. But for marginal Hall of Famers, for example, Jim Rice, it's a huge bonanza. Everything they touch after they can write HOF after their name triples in value immediately. Their autographs, their speaking fees, their appearance fees, their endorsement fees. And for many of them, it's a lifetime annuity.
You write of some of the retired players who've had, quote, whole corporations working to get them into Cooperstown. Who are some of those players, and how does that process work?
Players who want to get into the Hall of Fame and who aren't obvious selections in the past had been rather discreet about how they campaign because the mythology is that you simply ascend to the Hall of Fame like an angel ascending to the right hand of God. In reality, even going back, let's take Bob Lemon, the pitcher, 25 years ago or so when he was trying to get in, he sent a box with a lemon to every one of the baseball writers who constitute the Electoral College for the Hall. Today, that would be considered a pretty primitive means of campaigning. Mm-hmm. And one of the examples I used in Cooperstown Confidential is that Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela, wanted to get Dave Concepcion into the Hall of Fame. They simply hired a political consultant in Washington, a lobbyist, who opened an office and worked for several years for Concepcion.
How did that Dave Concepcion campaign work out?
Not too well. He didn't get in. He went past his 15 years of eligibility for the writers, and I think it's pretty clear he's not going to get in. On a veterans vote, the Hall of Famers comprise a committee of the whole of veterans. And their theoretical job is to vote in candidates who didn't get in the first 15 years of the writers voting. Mm-hmm. But since the Hall of Famers have had that job, they've never voted anybody in. I once asked Marvin Miller why that was, and he said, well, figure it out. Being in the Hall of Fame is worth a considerable amount of money. And so if there are 62 living Hall of Famers now, adding additional Hall of Famers means diluting the value per head of membership in the Hall of Fame.
The myth that baseball began in Cooperstown, New York, under the supervision of Abner Doubleday has been debunked over and over again. But why did those who created the myth feel that it was necessary to do so?
It's an interesting story because it takes place on a time not so different from ours when there was a huge wave of foreign immigration to the United States. And the establishment here thought that it would be a good thing to have sort of anchor institutions that everyone could identify with as American. And one of those was baseball. But the problem was that the leading expert was Henry Chadwick, and he said that baseball was invented in England. So they formed a public commission called the Mills Commission with some ex-senators and other public figures. And they determined that baseball was invented in Cooperstown in 1839. This is a total myth. And in fact, Abner Doubleday, who was a general in the Civil War on the Union side, wrote a couple of memoirs, and he never even mentioned baseball. Do you think that a guy who invented the national game would have remembered that in his memoirs?
What has all your research concerning the Hall of Fame led you to conclude about the fact that Pete Rose, the most accomplished hitter in Major League history, at least in terms of volume, is not in the Hall of Fame?
Well, it didn't take a lot of research to determine that, from my perspective, he should be in the Hall of Fame. I think the Hall of Fame is an institution that honors great baseball players, not great citizens. And I wouldn't argue with anyone who said that Pete Rose was a gambler and a liar. You know, he lied to the commissioner of baseball, which I guess is some sort of a terrible crime. But he clearly is one of the great players of all time. And, you know, it doesn't hurt him not to be in the Hall nearly so much as it hurts the Hall, because it makes it an incomplete place. And I would add, by the way, that Joe Jackson should also be in the Hall of Fame because, A, he was acquitted in the Black Sox scandal, which most people don't remember. But more than that, the whole thing was in 1919. This country has managed to forgive the Germans, the Japanese, the Korean communists, everybody. You know, it's been 90 years.
But not it's Joe Jackson.
Not Joe Jackson. He's like the last unforgiven figure. I think that he should be forgiven and put in, too.
There has been much discussion of how potential Hall of Famers like Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens, and Alex Rodriguez will fare when they become eligible for election. In your book, you short-circuit that discussion by recommending that the Hall should eliminate the character clause altogether. How would that work?
Well, it would be very simple. The Hall would say, please vote for the most qualified, best players of their time. The fact that some players used, you know, performance-enhancing drugs is basically meaningless on that scale of evaluation, because most of the players were probably using. And, you know, not everybody hit 73 home runs in a season, and not everybody pitched like Roger Clemens. You know, Pud Galvin in 1889 ingested monkey testosterone, and he's in the Hall of Fame. Mickey Mantle used amphetamines and steroids in 1961 during his home run race with Roger Maris. So, you know, they're not going to have any choice, I don't think. I think they're going to have to just bite the bullet on this, excuse the cliche, and say, yep, that's baseball in the modern era, and that's what the players have done, and we're going to continue as we have to choose the very best players of the era.
Zev Chaffetz is the author of Cooperstown Confidential, Heroes, Rogues, and the Inside Story of the Baseball Hall of Fame, published by Bloomsbury. He joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Zev, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks a lot. It was a pleasure.
Sunny days and Willie Mays. You'll be glad you took the trip to Cooperstown, the town where baseball, Cooperstown, the town.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. In 1952, marathoner Kizo Yamada represented Japan at the Helsinki Olympics. In 1953, he won the Boston Marathon. In 1964, he finished third in the Olympic Marathon in Tokyo. But since 45 years have now passed without a major win, Mr. Yamada, who is 81 years old, has decided to scale back his running. I'm not getting any younger, he said this week, so I won't run any more 42-kilometer races. I will still carry on running for fun to stay in shape. Known throughout the running community as Iron Man, Mr. Yamada has run a mere 3 marathons this year and plans to continue jogging a piddling 20 kilometers each day. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, running and running and more running, all in the same race. But first, what is so rare as a perfect game? Not many things, actually. Baseball had produced 17 perfect games before Thursday afternoon, when Mark Burley of the Chicago White Sox tossed one against the Tampa Bay Rays. Joining me now to discuss the occasion is John Greenberg of ESPNChicago.com. His column titled, Just Like You, But Perfect, appeared online yesterday. John, welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, thanks for having me, Bill. I appreciate it.
Roger Clemens never threw a perfect game. Neither did Walter Johnson or Christy Mathewson, for that matter. What enabled Mark Burley to join this most exclusive pitcher's club?
You know, I love what his manager, Ozzie Guillen, said after the game. He described it as strikes, a lot of guts, and confidence in himself. And that really defines Mark Burley. He's a guy that pitches to contact. He barely breaks 90 on his fastball. Throws a lot of change-ups, you know, slower fastballs, cutters, and it's just he sets his own rhythm and he sets his own tempo. He works fast, and, you know, a lot of hitters get off balance because of that, but, I mean, no one saw this coming. I mean, except his agent told me after the first inning he knew this could be a special day. You know, and what's even more impressive about this is look at the infield that played behind him. He's got a rookie third baseman who's still learning the position. He's got a talented but kind of erratic shortstop. He's got a reserve second baseman. And he's got a first baseman that barely played first base, Josh Fields. I mean, and he never pitched that catcher before. First time. First time that's ever happened. You know, it's really amazing on a lot of levels.
Your article was headlined, "Just Like You, But Perfect." The "Just Like You" was, I assume, a comment on Mark Burley's personality.
Absolutely. He's from Missouri. He was cut twice before making the baseball team as a junior. You know, he had to go to junior college. He was little. You know, he lives in the suburbs of Chicago, he told me, so he has a place to park his truck in the driveway. You know, he's like, I like to be able to drive to Blockbuster and find a parking spot. That's how Mark Burley thinks. You know, he wears cargo shorts and a T-shirt every game. He doesn't have a three-piece set of Louis Vuitton luggage. He's just a pretty basic, simple guy, and he's just like you, except maybe he's going to make $100 million.
Yeah, that would be a distinction.
No one's doing a pledge drive for Mark Burley, let's say that.
How did Burley react to the tension that must have been building inning to inning as it more and more innings going by without the Tampa Bay hitters reaching him?
That's another great thing about Mark. He doesn't sit by himself. He's always chatting with guys. He would go in the clubhouse, and the normal catcher, A.J. Pierzynski, was sitting in there part of the time, and they were joking around. And finally, A.J. wouldn't get up because he didn't want to break a jinx, and Mark convinced him to go into the dugout with the rest of the team. Mark's, you know, I'm sure he has some superstitions and stuff, but he's not really into that type of self-importance, I would say. Mm. You know, he's not a guy that's going to put some kind of gravitas toward this. Very low-key.
Most pitchers who have thrown no-hitters and perfect games have required at least one instance of spectacular assistance. Describe the catch Dwayne Wise made in the ninth inning of Thursday's game.
And that's one of those moments why we love sports. You know, if you want to define a moment on why people love sports in general, it's not Mark getting that final ground out. It's Dwayne Wise making that play. I mean, he takes, I think they figured it was 20 steps to the wall. 20 steps to the wall, outstretched glove, you know, the ball's popping out, and you could see he couldn't take his eye off the ball. That it was Dwayne Wise that made the play. He just went in the game for defense. He's 31, he's a journeyman, he's hitting 196. Everyone was just silent, and then you could hear the broadcasters just start screaming. As long as the Jumbotron exists at U.S. Cellular Field, that'll be played, I'd say, every game.
John, there were rumors 2 years ago that the White Sox might trade Mark Burley, and you wrote Thursday night that he may turn out to be the best pitcher the franchise has ever had, at least if we can find the candidates to guys who haven't pitched for other teams as well as for the White Sox.
Yeah.
It's 2 days later now. Does your judgment still hold?
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. I mean, there's some guys that are definitely guys that have won more games, you know, Billy Pearson, Ted Lyons. You know, but a few more years, there really won't be much of an argument. He amazes you with his consistency. You know, he doesn't strike out 20 guys like maybe Kerry Wood of the Cubs did, but at the same time, when do you see Mark Burley on the disabled list? He's the most beloved White Sox right now.
John Greenberg of ESPNChicago.com saw quite a game out there in Comiskey Park on Thursday afternoon. John, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Hey, no problem, Bill. Thanks for having me.
July is a prime month for Grand Slam sporting events. Wimbledon and the British Open need no introduction, and of course, everyone's familiar with last weekend's Vermont 100 Endurance Race. Well, actually, that one might need a little bit of introduction. Only a Game's Doug Trevoux has our story.
It's an overcast Friday evening, and hundreds of runners, their families, and friends have gathered under a massive white tent erected in Silver Hill Meadow in West Windsor, Vermont. They're here for the Vermont 100 Endurance Run. New York City resident Bob Falk is here for a shorter race, but he has completed 10 Vermont 100s and about 20 100-mile races overall. The 65-year-old attorney says the sport has a way of defining its participants.
I have a profession, but if people ask, what am I? I'd like to think I'm a runner. And I think anybody who does this type of stuff falls into that category.
The crowd is enjoying a pre-race meal of spaghetti, rice, salad, and ice cream, and washing it down with water and root beer. Tomorrow morning, the runners will begin a 100-mile race on a hilly course, mostly made up of dirt roads and trails, through Vermont woods and farmland. An ultramarathon is any race longer than the traditional 26.2 miles. The Vermont 100, Utah's Wasatch Front 100, California's Western States Endurance Run, and Colorado's Leadville Trail 100 make up ultramarathoning's Grand Slam. Hardcore runners attempt to achieve the slam by completing all four in the same summer. Most ultramarathons feature little pavement, and Vermont 100 race director Julia Hutchinson says wet weather in the Northeast has made the course especially muddy today.
And a lot of our jeep roads have water running down the center of them, so it's going to be a wet year, especially if it rains during the race. The horses will tear up the trail a little more than just regular running.
Yes, she said horses. Ultra running was born when people started running on foot during endurance horseback riding races. This is the 21st running of the Vermont 100 Endurance Run and the Vermont 100 Endurance Ride, one of the few remaining joint events of its kind. The races raise $20,000 to $30,000 a year for Vermont Adaptive Ski and Sports, an organization that helps people with physical and mental disabilities participate in skiing, sailing, cycling, and other activities. After dinner, runners and riders retire to rooms at local inns or to the RVs and tents lined up in the field. The course will soon be a busy place. 100 horses and riders will start their 100-mile rides 1 hour after the foot race begins. Later, there will also be 75 and 50-mile horse rides and a 100-kilometer run for humans. Just after 3 o'clock Saturday morning, runners start gathering for registration and a light breakfast. 58-year-old Phoenix, Arizona resident Dan Brendan has completed 15 100-mile races in the last year alone. He says unlike many races, ultramarathons are more about camaraderie than competition.
The big issue is, did you finish it? And even if you don't finish it, those that don't finish, they gave their all. Times really are immaterial to this. Times may be important to marathoners, but not to ultramarathoners.
The runners hail from 27 states, the District of Columbia, Canada, and England. Kathy Braga and Linda Kalinske traveled from Connecticut. It's raining, and both first-time 100-milers are wearing short raincoats and utility belts that would make Batman jealous.
We have everything from goo to Enduralites to Perpetuum powder. We do have some toilet paper.
Chapstick.
We have
Glide.
Eye drops.
Flashlight. Bug spray.
Yeah.
The 236 runners line up for the 4 a.m. start. It's still dark, so most are wearing headlamps.
3, 2, 1.
The runners head downhill on a dirt road into the darkness. Yellow plastic plates with black arrows nailed to trees and fence posts mark the course. Every few hundred yards, a small glow stick hangs from a tree branch over the middle of the trail. Most 100-mile races require ultra-running experience, usually finishing a 50-mile race in 12 hours or less, and at least 8 hours of volunteer work at another ultramarathon. By midday, the sun is out. The temperature is in the upper 70s, but the humidity is low. The course has 29 aid stations. Most provide food, water, and supplies, and each has a name. Runners pass through 10 Bear Station at mile 47 now and will be back at mile 70. As runners, riders, and horses arrive, volunteers and supporters cheer them on. 10 Bear is one of the stations where runners must weigh in. Dr. Robert Rinaldi is the Vermont 100's medical director.
We weigh them before the race, and we've calculated their weights. We don't want them to lose more than 5%. If they're between 5 and 7%, we give them a warning.
Rinaldi says after a loss of 7% body weight, a person is pulled out of the race. A runner approaches limping. Rinaldi examines Annette Bednoski's foot. He determines she has tendonitis and advises Bednoski to drop out, but leaves the decision up to her. It's the Jefferson, North Carolina resident's first Vermont 100, but she's run 66 ultramarathons and is determined to keep going.
I know it's going to get hard, but I mean, until I can't move or until I put myself or someone else in danger, then there's no reason to stop. That's the way I look at it.
By Saturday evening, most of the horses have finished and are being fed and washed. The finish line is just across the field from where the race began. Runners are allowed to have a pacer for encouragement after mile 70.
Way to go!
Jack Pilla crosses the line with an official time of 16 hours, 36 minutes, and 21 seconds. Coming off two consecutive third-place finishes, Pilla says his first win is a satisfying accomplishment.
And for an old guy, too.
And how old are you?
51. So I beat all the youngins.
So you're getting better with age?
Yes, getting wiser. Yes.
Pilla is the oldest Vermont 100 winner. He lives in Charlotte, Vermont, and he's also the first Vermonter to win the run. Race director Julia Hutchinson says Pilla's victory is a fitting tribute to her father, who died of a heart attack last year after 6 years of organizing the run.
We really wanted a Vermonter to win the Vermont 100, and so Dad was always checking up on Jack, hoping he was going to be the one to make it.
The second runner comes in nearly 45 minutes behind Pilla. The first female, Canadian runner Stephanie Case, finishes in 18 hours and 36 minutes, ninth overall. Only about a quarter of the field earns a belt buckle, the traditional ultramarathon award for finishing in under 24 hours. Many spend all night and most of the next morning trying to beat the 30-hour cutoff, and only 173 of the original 236 succeed. Cramping, injuries, or dehydration force some to drop out. Arlington, Virginia resident Carolyn Williams dropped out at mile 56. She has completed other 100-mile races, but has never made it past 95 miles in four tries here. Still, Williams says she'll definitely be back.
I don't look at the distance, per se, you know, although it is a number, but I look at being out there. I just love the experience of running into the night and then seeing the next sunrise.
Sunday before the awards ceremony, the slow and fast eat side by side, sharing stories of aches and pains, favorite scenery along the trail, and times they thought they wouldn't make it. Among them is Annette Bednoski, the runner diagnosed with tendonitis at mile 47. Bednoski forged ahead and finished in just over 21 hours, with a purple foot and ankle to show for it. She says though she's had faster times, this finish will always stand out in her memory.
I'm just really pleased and have so much gratitude for my pacer and for the organizers here that were just so encouraging. They didn't say, no, you fool. They said, go, go, go if you can.
For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribou.
You're listening to Only a Game. A surprising comparison surfaced in a recent email. Jay Sandvoss, a WBUR listener, began his missive by saying, "Great show, great stories, keep it up." Having softened us up, he wrote, "Like the Grateful Dead concerts of yore, the same structure every week can be a bit tiresome. What if you let off the show with Charlie? Don't tell me, I figured it out. He was a born number 8 hitter and can't perform higher in the order." No, Jay, I don't think that's accurate. Charlie would be Charlie, early or late, but it takes me about 3/4 of an hour to think up the questions that I'll ask him. Jason Bardwell emailed in response to Beckham Experiment author Grant Wall's contention that English fans had forgiven David Beckham for getting a red card in the 1998 World Cup when he began playing brilliantly for Manchester United. Mostly, it was the last-second free kick against Greece that secured England's qualification for the 2002 World Cup that had fans finally forgiving him, wrote Mr. Bardwell, who is apparently a fan of Arsenal, Liverpool, or Chelsea. Byron Nam, who listens to the program on WYPR in Baltimore, couldn't care less about such distinctions. In response to last week's program, which featured the Beckham Experiment interview and my story about the Veterans Cup soccer tournament, Mr. Nam wrote, "Please, 3 exclamation points. No more soccer, 5 exclamation points. Paul Riza, who hears only a game on KPBS in San Diego, and Quentin Kensler, who listens on KXCV in Marysville, Missouri, both caught an error in our story about the future of baseball's All-Star Game. In that story, our reporter identified the Disney Company as the owners of the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim. In fact, Disney sold the team to Arturo Moreno 6 years ago. As Mr. Reza put it in his email, it is disappointing that the homework was not done. Thank you for using that passive voice, Mr. Reza. Embarrassment was registered over the mistake which was made. Actively seek out our website, onlyagame.org, and send us your comments, complaints, corrections, or congratulations. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. Our address is onlyagame, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And AVFX, Boston-based and serving the nation with audiovisual staging tools at corporate meetings, trade shows, and live events. Location information at avfx.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On Monday, mixed martial arts competitor Leopoldo was sentenced to 10 days community service and referred to a drug diversion program following an arrest for possessing marijuana and impersonating a police officer. For reasons that remain unclear, a number of mixed martial arts websites concluded from those circumstances that Leopoldo had died after suffering a heart attack, and they reported same. Some newspapers followed suit. Leopoldo learned of his alleged demise when his manager called and said, according to the media, "You're dead." "It scared me," he said. "I wondered, are they predicting the future or am I cursed?" The coroner's office in Orange County, California, received more than 200 calls on Tuesday regarding Leopoldo, who eventually held a press conference to show off his pulse.
"I'm dead, but I don't know.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a pool with a view and a history. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
We start with a question of perfects today. Charlie, which was better, Mark Burley pitching a perfect game against Tampa Bay on Thursday or Dwayne Wise's catch that made Burley's game perfect?
Well, I think that Burley will get all the stuff sent to the Cooperstown, but Dwayne Wise has had his moment in the sun as a major league player, and it's just terrific. The only catch I can think of in a regular season game that compares to it is the over-the-shoulder one that Carl Yastrzemski gave to, at least for a moment, save Billy Rohr's no-hitter in 1967. But this was terrific because it was a snow cone until he hit the ground.
And the ball popped up,
and
he grabbed it with his bare hand.
And he grabbed it on the way out. And he had just come back off the DL from an injury sustained into, wait for it, running into a fence.
Right. White Sox fans have a new signature moment, obviously, in Burley's perfect game. Is it fair to say that for Dodgers fans, the signature moment is now Manny Ramirez hitting a grand slam on, well, you tell everybody why this grand slam happened on an especially significant day.
This may well sound redundant to some people, but it was Manny Ramirez bobblehead night.
As which night is not.
And yes, he teed one up against the Reds and won the game. Good for them. Good for him.
Any new reasons this week to suppose that all is not well with the New York Mets organization?
Okay, here's a story from the New York Daily News. Tony Bernazard, the vice president for player development, who's apparently on thin ice with the organization, called a minor league player under his, obviously part of his portfolio, a nasty name, and then challenged him to a fight. Now, this is the kind of stuff that hasn't happened in baseball since the 1920s. This is throwback controversy.
Excellent.
We have throwback jerseys. Now we have throwback controversies.
From Monday through Wednesday, the Washington Nationals accomplished something extraordinary. They won a series. Any surprise regarding which team they beat twice in three games?
Well, considering that the front office is brawling with the hired help, you will not be surprised to know it was the New York Mets. But let me tell you something. The Washington Nationals are a terrible team, and the Expos should have moved to Havana like I suggested.
Mm-hmm.
I will say that forever.
Well, it may not be too late. Jose Guillen of the Kansas City Royals is presently earning $12 million a year. Charlie, how far does Guillen have to look to find somebody who doesn't think that he's worth that kind of money?
Not very far. Every morning when he gets up in the mirror, he shaves, quote, "If I suck, then I suck, and I suck. That's the way I'm playing. If you suck, you suck. You have to take responsibility in this game, and right now that's the way I feel. Yes, I suck." Thank you for sharing, Jose.
Major League Baseball is tired of being embarrassed by 23-year-old infielders from Latin America who are actually 36. So the league is running genetic tests to determine the age of certain prospects. There must be an easier way to do this.
Look, I'm the endless bad fairy on the testing thing here, okay? This is a massive invasion of personal privacy. Baseball has no right to be doing this, and I hope they lose a multi-quadrillion dollar lawsuit over it.
Michael Vick was released from house arrest on Monday, Charlie, and the convicted felon-slash-unemployed quarterback met with NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell on Wednesday. Mr. Goodell is reportedly considering allowing Vick to return after sitting out four games. So, any teams that will employ him under those conditions?
Well, it sort of restricts his, not that his movement within the NFL wasn't restricted to start with, but the people who would be most likely to hire him are people who don't have a starting quarterback right now. And those teams will now be reluctant to hire him because even if they bring him in, they can't use him for a quarter of the season. So this will circumscribe his movement a little bit. I still think that what makes the National Football League most nervous about Michael Vick is not the dogfighting conviction and the fact that he went to Leavenworth, but because he was also part of an interstate gambling ring, and they don't want any part of that. So I think that's why the diplomacy on this one has been so delicate.
Charlie, nobody covers sports in more minutia than ESPN. So how did the cable sports network miss the not-so-little story of Steelers quarterback Ben Roethlisberger being sued for sexual assault?
Well, I'd like for this to be the beginning of a spasm of common sense where we don't automatically report allegations as though they're fact and indictments as though there were convictions. But this is a very, very bizarre thing because the excuse they gave, which is quote-unquote, "We don't cover civil suits," is just crazy because they've covered civil suits by the carload since ESPN started. So I don't really have a good explanation for the fact that they didn't cover this as though there was a real case here, although I am glad that they didn't, because as it turns out, there apparently wasn't.
A scandal erupted in the SEC earlier this week, Charlie, which led the Tampa Tribune to call for all of the SEC head football coaches to be locked in a room and denied food and text messaging until the culprit confessed. Thankfully, South Carolina's Steve Spurrier raised his hand and acknowledged that he was the guy who'd made a terrible mistake. What was Coach Spurrier's transgression?
And Coach Spurrier, a Florida alum, had better watch out for the wrath of the Florida alumni. And given Tim Tebow's obvious close relationship with the Almighty's, Coach Spurrier might want to look out for a plague of frogs and locusts in his backyard. He left Tim Tebow off his all-SEC ballot. The Heisman Trophy doesn't count for anything.
Still has a job?
It's unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
It's a world gone mad, Bill.
Earlier this week, Lance Armstrong conceded the Tour de France to his teammate Alberto Contador. So how is it that he has a ride for 2010, no matter who ends up on the podium tomorrow?
Well, because Radio Shack has stepped in. He's going to ride for Radio Shack next time. And I hope that, you know, the transistorized bicycle works out well for him.
FINA, the world swimming governing body, passed a new regulation this week requiring that swimsuits for males cover no more than waist to knees, and suits for females should stop at the shoulders. Is FINA trying to bring sexy back to swimming competition?
Wait a minute.
Or what?
They stop at the shoulder, like, from above? Because that's gonna send the ratings for Olympic swimming through the roof, if that's the case.
Oh,
no, this is FINA being enormously silly. If the suits work, who cares? It's, I mean, this is not a performance-enhancing drug. If you can improve the technology, this to me is the equivalent of fiberglass pole vaulting poles.
Which wouldn't help any swimmer.
That's a very good point by you.
Ed O'Bannon last played college basketball in 1995, so you would think that his concern with the NCAA would have ended a long time ago, but it hasn't. Why not?
Because the NCAA is a bunch of conscienceless profiteers. That's why. And they're continuing to use his image to sell video games, you know, their college basketball video game, and Ed O'Bannon wants a piece, and frankly, he deserves it.
Turning to golf, how long before Tom Watson's opponents start demanding that the PGA test him for performance enhancers at every tee?
Now, first of all, Watson, if you're listening, and I know you are, stop making me feel really crummy at the kind of shape I'm in, okay? Stop doing this to me. It was one thing to do it at the British Open. We were all happy about it. But shooting a 367 in the opening round of the senior British Open is going too far. Stop making me look foolish, Watson.
A new book about LeBron James contains the revelation that when he was in high school, LeBron James smoked marijuana. And that's a shame, because think how tall he'd have been if he hadn't stunted his growth.
Yes, I am not surprised, although the quote is interesting. He said, "We had become big-headed jerks, me in particular, and we're to blame for that, but so are the adults who treated that way and then sat back and smugly watched the self-destruction," unquote. Proof that occasionally marijuana can sharpen the perceptions.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
I'm so high, so dry, sailing in the sky. Let's blow some gauge, I'm on a rampage, and Jack, I'm mellow.
To experience Only a Game's magical web world, please visit onlyagame.org.
The world seems nice, I'm so right, and Jack. I'm on a bender, I'm so high, so dry, sailing in the sky, pass the boat around, I can't come down, and Jack, I'm mellow.
The World Swimming Championships are underway in Rome. The ancient city's major sports venue was restored and upgraded in time to host the event. Foro Italico, as it's called, used to have another name, Foro Mussolini. The late dictator commissioned the facility in 1928. It's a model of fascist art and architecture designed to symbolize the importance of sports in Benito Mussolini's dictatorship. From Rome, Nancy Greenlease reports on the gleaming marvel that still makes Italians uncomfortable.
Athletes and spectators arriving at Foro Italico know immediately who used to be in charge. Sarah Morgan, a docent for Context Travel, peers up at a 55-foot-tall monument.
This is the obelisk, Mussolini's obelisk, that is still quite obviously Mussolini's obelisk. They haven't made any attempt to erase his name that was carved into the marble.
Mussolini Dukes, or Mussolini Leader, runs down the middle of the restored, blindingly white marble. Erected in 1932, the single piece of stone came from the Tuscan town that provided marble for many of ancient Rome's monuments. The Duce wanted to create his own forum that would surpass those of Caesar and Augustus. Morgan, who wrote her doctoral thesis on gender and sports in fascist Italy, says stepping into history served the party's contemporary needs.
Well, it was really the era that they could hark back to show Italy's greatness. And also when Rome had this empire. So they used the ideas and the symbols of ancient Rome both to inspire modern Italians to feel proud about themselves and to be enthused about the fascist project, but also almost as a way of justifying what they were doing.
The propaganda greets you every step of the way in the mosaics that stretch from the obelisk to the stadiums. Duce, Duce, Duce is spelled out over and over in the complex, designed by architect Enrico Del Debbio. And sports play a key role, too. Morgan gazes down.
Well, here are some of the sporting figures. Discus throwers. Who do we have? Gymnasts here on the rings.
Everywhere are mosaics of muscular men engaged in Mussolini-approved sports, like fencing, javelin tossing, and hockey. Cycling isn't represented because at the time the Duce considered it a communist sport. The fascists ran their own sports leagues and banned all others. Morgan says athletics were a pillar in the party's platform.
So the fascists wanted to use sport to make Italians fitter, to project an image of a stronger, more virile Italy, and as well military preparing them for war.
But the mosaics show that Mussolini had no plans to use primitive weapons during his invasion of Ethiopia or during World War II.
For us, I think today, the curious mosaics are these ones with tanks and aeroplanes and soldiers. Okay, so it's saying finally Italy has its empire. You know, it sort of looks like an ancient mosaic, but then we have tanks in it.
In Rome's Stadio dei Marmi, Italians sing the national anthem during the recent World Swimming Championships opening ceremonies. The Allies liberated Rome in 1944, yet the city was left with this reminder. The track is rimmed with 60 white marble statues of naked gladiatorial sportsmen. A little odd for their depiction of boxers, basketball players, and skiers. Spectator Valerio Rasciatore's favorite sits apart from the others.
Hercules at the entrance, who symbolizes Rome. He's the most handsome of all.
During the fascist regime, young men about Rasciatore's age attended the attached Fascist Physical Education Academy. They marched on this field for visiting dignitaries, including Hitler. Much has changed as tonight pop star Claudio Baglioni belts out a song titled Un Solo Mondo, or One World Only. Rasciatore says this stadium is striking, but often ignored because of its neighbor. The 1960 Olympic Stadium sits a few steps away, the new point of reference for many younger Romans who come here to cheer for the city's soccer teams. Yet Rasciatore says this ancient city can't hide from its history.
Rome and its people are linked more than other Italians to fascism because the city was its power center. And so it's looked at, on one hand, for the positive things accomplished, but above all for its negatives.
I don't justify the period. I want to be very clear about that. But I think for the history, for the art, it's a very good example.
That's Novella Caligaris, the first Italian ever to win an Olympic medal in swimming. She's now a painter. The silver and bronze medalist at the 1972 Games trained at Foro Italico's 50-meter indoor pool. During pre-meet rehearsals, synchronized swimmers practice in this neoclassical wonder. Their legs stab from the water in this pool that resembles an ancient Roman bath. Mosaics of seahorses and lobsters cover the deck, and the walls explode with blue prancing horses and tanned runners. But Caligaris admits that despite the facility's beauty, she didn't enjoy training here.
For Italico, for the swimmer, it's not so good because it's very dark, it's very deep, and we said like a tomb. You know, when you swim, your head is in the water, you know? You don't can look around.
Mussolini put particular emphasis on the sport of swimming. But much to his dismay, Italians didn't take the plunge. And it's still not a swimming nation, in reaction, some scholars say, to the fascist takeover of sports in the 1930s. Piero May of the World Championships Organizing Committee has a hidden pool to reveal, across a roof and tucked between two buildings.
Vediamo la piscina pensile nella quale.
We're looking at what's called the hanging pool. Mussolini swam here during fascist times. Now, fortunately, it's a swimming school for kids because the world has changed. Thank God.
Grazie a Dio.
The marble pool, also decorated with mosaics, won't be used during the games. May says for years this pool and other facilities were neglected and threatened with destruction because they symbolized Mussolini's fascist regime.
Instead, the Foro was rediscovered apart from its ideology, the beauty of its architecture, its modernity, despite the era in which it was constructed. In my opinion, there's no other sporting complex in the world like Foro Italico.
Swimmer Novella Caligaris says 70 years is enough time for Italians to separate the Foro Italico from its dark history. The Eternal City has done it before.
You have Colosseum, and inside the Colosseum, the Roman give the Christian people to the lions, you know, but never cover the Colosseum.
This weekend, the swimming competition begins, an opportunity to provide new, positive memories from Foro Italico. For Only a Game, I'm Nancy Greenlace in Rome.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Josh Levenshurst. Special thanks to Peter the Voice Lydotes. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view Nancy Greenlease's Foro Italico photo gallery or Doug Tribou's Vermont 100 endurance race pictures, please visit onlyagame.org. While you're there, you can also download our weekly podcasts, learn more about the music you hear on our program, or listen to stories past and present. Pretty good deal. Our final word is from Burlington, Vermont resident Michael Hall, who says he was ready for the horses that share the course at the Vermont 100 Endurance Race.
I actually trained for that. No, I didn't.
Hey, Wilbur, tell him to train next time or stay in his barn.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.